is joining us. He is HSBC Private Banking and Wealth Management Chief Investment Officer. Willem, it is good to see you. So I talked about some of the events we're looking ahead to this week. It feels like, some choppiness in the equity markets aside last week, that market participants are sort of shunting aside a lot of concerns right now, whether it be the Delta variant, whether it be crackdowns regulatory-wise in China. Do you think that that's the right thing to do? Do you think that the positives outweigh the negatives when it comes to equities right now?
Well, we're probably now in the mid-cycle stage, which is, I think, still traditionally a positive environment for equity markets, for riskier assets. And, you know, whilst you have slightly slower growth, maybe some more hiccups around COVID and, you know, it's and also around, obviously, the supply chain, it's basically, the recovery can be delayed a little bit, but probably not derailed. So that combination of that, of continued, even though a little bit slower growth, together with a very gradual Fed, should still be a positive risk environment for equity. So we remain overweight on equities. We remain invested in the bond market as well, in high yield emerging markets. Slower upside, but still important to remain invested because obviously cash is not an alternative.
What sectors do you remain overweight? Well, earlier in the show, we were talking about the street seems to be getting a little more bearish on consumer cyclicals in some parts of tech.
So, if you indeed go into the mid-cycle stage, as we believe, you would want to take profit on a few early cyclicals. And we have done that in the industrial space and in the materials as well. So we've taken profit there. We still like consumer cyclicals because, indeed, we do think that recovery, again, is delayed, not derailed. Consumers have accumulated quite a lot of savings, especially in the U.S., but also around the world. You still have unemployment falling. You have some upside wage pressure. That being said, obviously now consumer confidence has its ups and downs with the COVID ups and downs, but ultimately that money will be spent. You mentioned technology, which is traditionally a good sector to be in the mid-cycle, also because obviously we think that the Fed is going to be slow in hiking interest rates or tapering, so that should keep your bond yields low and support growth stocks. But even within the consumer cyclical sector, there are a number of companies that are technology-like. And actually within, almost all of the sectors, there are, these technological leaders. And those are the ones that we look for, those that are savvy at using AI, doing inventory management, marketing, logistics much better than the others. Those are the winners, we think, and will continue to be the winners.
Willem, I want to dig more into the Fed for just a moment, given that we've got Jackson Hole later this week. You mentioned you think bond yields are going to remain low. There are a couple of outliers to that view emerging on Wall Street and elsewhere. And of course, they've ended up being wrong this year. We saw yields go up and then they've come back down. What do you think is going to keep those yields low at these levels? Is it just the fact that the Fed is not going to act and that inflation is going to sort of pass through here and not be more sustained?
Yeah, so we've traditionally been the outlier on the lower side, looking for the 1 to 1.5% range, and we're bang in the middle of that now. We do think that obviously the Fed is looking at the improvement in the labor market, but if you look at a more broader set of data, actually U.S. Economic growth and economic data has been disappointing versus expectations. You now also have the impact, obviously, of China slowing, and the Fed is trying to figure out what impact that will have on U.S. growth. And then there is just the variable of uncertainty, which obviously means that the Fed is going to be a little bit more prudent. The more uncertainty you have, the less you have visibility, the more prudent you need to be. So they are going to act relatively slowly. With regard to tapering, we had the taper tantrum in 2013. That was the first time they had to do it. It surprised us. It surprised the market. Now, obviously, it's much less of a surprise. The Fed has learned from it. The market has learned from it. They are guiding more, and that should keep bond yields low as well. And then there is the deflationary effect of technology, of the global labor market that we work in and so on, that are structural elements that keep bond yields low. So a whole series of reasons to continue to expect low bond yields.
And reports over the weekend have Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen supporting another term for Fed Chair Jerome Powell. Let's say that doesn't go down that way. How disruptive would it be if Jerome Powell is not kept as Fed chairman?
Well, you know, I think, you know, the market is going to look for, you know, a gradual change. You know, it is obviously the chair, but there are also all of the other members, you know, and that's important, you know, and then the Fed policy is set as a function of the data, you know, so therefore it is a slow moving you know, policy, you know, that could change. So I think the market, you know, will also obviously look at, you know, who is the candidate that comes in, you know, and, you know, we will all assume that it, obviously it's a very competent candidate that comes in together with all of the other people that remain in place. So I don't think necessarily the market would read too much into it, you know, either way. I don't think that's what we are focusing on. We are focusing on the data. You know, and on the relative merits of tapering and of interest rate hikes. Those interest rate hikes, we only expect to see them in 2023. So again, you know, very slow moving, you know, policy, and that's positive for markets, obviously, right? You know, if you have that extended growth and a very slow change in monetary policy in the U.S. and around the world, that's good for equities.
And so far, of course, that has been borne out and has been the case. We'll see if it continues to be so. Willem Sells, good to catch up with you. Thank you so much. HSBC Private Banking and Wealth Management Chief Investment Officer. It looks like employees and potential employees are in the driver's seat in this job market. We've talked a lot about this trend. But do they have all the information they need when they're looking for a job? Because as we know, pay is only one slice of that picture. We are joined now by Mary Childs. She is the co-host of NPR's Planet Money and also the co-author of a new report on Quartz.com that looks at benefits among financial firms. And Mary, I want to start out by you talked about on Twitter how you came to do this report in the first place. And I actually want to start there because I think it's really important, the sort of context for why you decided to look into this data. So if you don't mind, tell us sort of how this report came about.
Sure. It was quite a journey. So I basically had dinner with some friends 2.5, almost 3 years ago. And, you know, four women having dinner talking about, you know, a lot of them were considering having a baby. And they all worked in finance. I'm a journalist. I kind of, you know, cover finance. But the three women that I was having dinner with, none of them could quite parse what their benefits policies were. They couldn't figure out what their parental leave policies would be. So one of them, literally the only copy of the benefits was in like a physical binder in a desk drawer in the HR person's like area. And she had to like rummage through their stuff to find out. And they didn't really have a policy for someone like her who was considering surrogacy. And then another one ended up having to kind of bilaterally negotiate her leave with her boss. I think she was the second person in her firm's 30 or 40 year history to take maternity leave, which like I personally object to saying maternity. I have a whole thing that I can evangelize about later. But basically they just were discussing the degree to which they have no clue what they were offered, and finding out was really difficult. And so that to me was just like, wait, why is this so hard? Aren't we supposed to think about benefits as this competitive advantage? Isn't this supposed to be a way that we, you know, attract and retain talent as, you know, this like very wealthy industry in a very wealthy country? And yet, if you bring it up in your you only find out like late stage in the negotiations for a new job when you've, you know, probably you're like really close to already signing and you're like, oh, by the way, like, do you mind letting me know what kind of parental leave you have? And then you've like flagged to everyone that you might have a baby, which people love. So it just becomes this whole like spiral of difficulty. And I just kind of thought like, why don't we have this transparency? Why isn't this on like Glassdoor or something? And then I decided somewhat cavalierly that I would just go apply that transparency myself. Like I'm a journalist, I can just go ask. And that was far more work than I expected, but we ended up canvassing 101 different financial firms just trying to ask for their policies, and we got 32 responses, which was far higher than I expected at first, frankly. Like at first I thought I would get a lot. And then as I started getting all this like weird friction from the PR people that represent these firms, they're like, wait, why? Why do you need this information? How's it going to be used? There are regulatory reasons why we can't. There are compliance reasons why we can't. And I'd be like, what are those reasons? And they'd be like, sorry, I misspoke. It doesn't seem, I mean, there are regional differences for sure.
They just didn't want to tell you. That was the reason.
They didn't want to tell me.
Like, go away, Mary.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, I mean, but that to me is so fascinating because you see stories all the time. You know, there was a story last week, Goldman Sachs going to raise the pay for junior bankers. They have no problem with that stuff getting out there, right? So right. That is fascinating to me. And I mean, you were surprised at how many responses you get, but I was actually kind of surprised at how few companies responded to you. That they weren't willing to be more transparent about this. I mean, to me, does it read tone deaf in this environment where, like, it's really hard to find people and they are saying to you very loud and clearly that this stuff is important to them?
Completely. And I think you're exactly right. Like, you know, it was such a dental appointment getting these all this data from the firms. Like, they would not, you know, I had to be on calls with like hundreds of different PR people trying to just like handhold to get the data. And once we started to get it, you know, you'll see in the types of firms that did end up disclosing, like 0.72 was one of the ones that was very happy that, you know, Steve Cohen's firm, and they say that they compete with tech firms. And so, you know, you look kind of across the way at technology firms that have like ping pong in the office or whatever, and they are accustomed to some extent to like touting their benefits, but it's always the silly stuff like beanbag chairs or something. And you're like, no, I want to know if my medical premia are covered.
And Mary, historically, there's been a lot of focus on Bridgewater's culture, Ray Dalio, principals. Clearly he runs the shop like a different type of company. What did you find here from a Bridgewater perspective?
Bridgewater's were actually very compelling. They have a policy where you have to take 15 days of vacation per year, which, like, as a person who compulsively does not take vacation, you know, I'm not a role model here, like, absolutely would love for someone to force me to take vacation. And that's obviously increasingly critical as we as a society talk about burnout and everyone, you know, working from home has blurred the boundaries of work and the rest of their lives. They also have a policy where they have 6 Bridgewater-wide holidays and they are attached to weekends. So what ends up happening is, like in normal cultures, if you take a vacation, your team might suffer. You might come back to the office and everyone's like, oh, thank God you're here. We couldn't do XYZ. We needed you. And so you're kind of on vacation, like checking your email, making sure no one's like in pain because you went on vacation. These 6 Bridgewater-wide holidays mean that you end up not hurting your team. Everyone is off. So no one's going to be like, oh, that guy, he took vacation. So I feel like that's actually, like, you know, for all the interesting Bridgewater culture. And like, I should note that I can't speak to how these are implemented. You know, they mandate the 15-day vacation policy, but otherwise it gets very hard to say, oh, you know, XYZ firm has fantastic parental leave. Like, do people actually take it? I don't know. And there to report that out would be like incredibly difficult to the point of probably impossible. But I was kind of pleasantly surprised by what Bridgewater offered, for sure.
Well, and then there's the question of if when you're not on vacation, are you working an 80-hour week, right? I mean, right. That I guess is the other part of the equation. I am curious what you found on, let's call it parental leave, right? On that front, and not just traditional parental leave, but you also dug into things like adoption and surrogacy. What did you find on that front?
Yeah, it varied pretty widely. I think firms are kind of waking up. You know, the one of the things that I found really interesting was the language that people use. You know, I mentioned that I evangelize about saying parental leave instead of maternity versus paternity, because, you know, if we stop making that delineation, we are going to close off this like huge liability where, you know, if you specify your policy by gender, I just don't understand why you would do that, because like, you're just opening yourself up for a lawsuit in my view. You know, JP Morgan literally had a big settlement a couple of years ago over primary versus secondary caregiver. So I think the language that firms use is definitely, you know, in flux right now. People are trying to figure out, HR is clearly trying to figure out across the board what the right terminology is to use and what the right policies are. But some of the firms, you know, Goldman and UBS, I can highlight, have gender neutral and kind of caregiver status neutral leave policies, which is to say, if you are the primary parent or the secondary parent, which, you know, we can dig into that another day, you get the same amount of weeks. You get 20 weeks off. And that is, I think, so, you know, I just had a baby and it was absolutely bananas to me that, you know, my husband is self-employed. So he was able to work with me and help me with the baby. And I was like, you know, at week like 18, I was like, wait, some people don't get this? Like, are you kidding me? So, you know, not to be the kind of person who thinks that this should happen for everyone because I just experienced it, but also I did just experience it and it was super acute. And I think the migration in the, I think we're making really good headway societally on parental leave. You know, the financial firms do lead the way in a lot of respects on that one. And we've seen really massive progress in the past 3 to 5 years.
We have. And as someone who has a lot more distance between myself and my own parental leave, I still feel very strongly that this is something short of all of us moving to Scandinavia, that American companies and frankly, the American government really need to get, they really need to get on board with this. Mary, it's an awesome story and everyone should go check it out on QZ.com. It's great to catch up with you, Mary Childs, NPR Planet Money co-host. So Karen Parkhill is back with us. She is the Medtronic CFO, as well as our Anjali Kamlani, who covers healthcare for us. Karen, thanks for being here. And it seems as though elective surgeries really was something that helped give you guys a lift in the quarter. Talk to me about how much that contributed to your numbers, because, of course, many of your devices are used in necessary operations and procedures as well.
Thanks, Julie. Yes, we had a really good, strong quarter, and it was a great start to our fiscal year. We saw continued progression throughout the quarter, each month getting better, including July better than June. And that was driven by the strength of procedures coming back, as well as the strength of our new product introductions that we had across many of our businesses. And we continued to gain share across many of our businesses, including our three largest, which are cardiac rhythm management that you mentioned, our spine business, and our surgical instrumentation business.
Karen, Anjali here. I wanted to know about how the company sees this sort of rise in interest, at least with remote monitoring devices and generally medical devices. I know there's been a shift over the years from sort of inpatient to outpatient surgeries, and now it seems like the next step is forming thanks to the pandemic. Do you feel like the company is sort of positioned right and looking either through M&A or its own pipeline to sort of fit the bill?
Thanks, Anjali. We are very excited about what remote monitoring can do for our patients today and going forward, and we are investing heavily in that space. If you think about remote monitoring, particularly during the pandemic, we quickly instituted remote monitoring for our ventilators during the pandemic, and we're able to monitor those patients, not necessarily inside the room with the patient, but outside quite heavily. We also have insertable cardiac diagnostic monitors now that with our Link devices that can monitor the heartbeats and heart issues with patients 24/7. So we're really excited about what that can do for patients going forward.
And Karen, we're looking at the breakdown of revenue by the different units. I also want to talk about the breakdown of domestic versus international. You get just over half of your revenue, or at least you did this quarter, from the United States. As we see how COVID has been spreading around the globe at different times, what has that meant for the sort of cadence of your revenue growth around the globe?
Yeah, thanks, Julie. In terms of U.S. revenue. Yes, it is over half of our revenue comes from the United States. And we are seeing the impact of the Delta variant currently right now. We saw it actually in the last couple of weeks of July, which was the end of our first quarter. And we're seeing that continue into August. You know, we're monitoring it closely, and we believe that the impact that this variant will have will be short-lived. We do believe that we'll recover quite quickly. We expect the infection rate to probably peak around August, the end of August or early September. And the ICU capacity and hospital bed capacity to get better a few weeks after that infection peak. And so we expect by the tail end of our second quarter, clearly improvement in procedure levels and the back half of our fiscal year to be stronger than the first.
And Karen, if you could give me a little bit more color on that, because what I imagine is, as we see ICUs, as you said, quite busy, particularly not just around the globe in certain places, but here in the U.S., particularly in the Southeast, I would imagine that you are seeing the effect that you saw at one time in the entire United States, people pushing off certain procedures. From what you saw then and a catch up, is that what you expect to see again? And is that indeed what happened? In other words, did most of the procedures that people put off, did they end up starting to try to do them during the reprieve that we had in the spring going into the summer?
Yes, yes, indeed, we did see a catch up in the prior waves of COVID from that procedure volume. And we hope and expect that to happen here. And with each wave of COVID, that the time frame between impact and catch up has shortened. Because hospitals are better equipped to deal with patients, because vaccination rates have increased across this country and across the world, and because I think patients are learning to deal with COVID and get back into the hospital to have those important procedures that they need.
Karen, I want to pivot a little bit to what's going on in DC. There's a lot of conversation about generally the cost of healthcare. And in my conversation with hospital CEOs over the years, medical devices have come among the list of the most expensive things that they need to account for. I'm curious on your thoughts on this and whether or not you see sort of the industry needing to address this in any way, or have you had conversations, you know, among the C-suite about this?
You know, we clearly focus on pricing our products very appropriately. And in fact, it's embedded in our mission, that our mission says that we need to make a fair profit to continue in our innovation and to meet our obligations. It doesn't say to maximize profit, it says to make a fair profit. And when we think about the prices of our devices, these are important life-saving devices that help improve outcomes. And with those improvements in outcomes, we are focused on driving the total cost of healthcare down, because our devices do just that. They reduce infection rates in certain cases, they reduce other complications, and as a result, the total cost of healthcare comes down because of our devices.
And Karen, something else I noticed in your forecast from this morning, and I apologize because in prepping for the show, I didn't have a chance to listen to the call, so perhaps this was addressed. You guys raised the lower end of your earnings per share forecast. You didn't raise your revenue forecast for the full year. And so I'm wondering where that upside is coming from, especially, and I know that healthcare costs for input costs for you guys, as well as prices, have been rising pretty steadily even before the pandemic. The rest of the world is sort of catching up at this point. But I am curious where that lever came from that allowed you to raise that EPS forecast without raising the revenue forecast.
Yeah. So we had a really strong first quarter where we beat consensus on the bottom line by 9 cents. And that gave us confidence to increase the lower end of our EPS range for guidance for the full year. You know, we're still really confident in our ability to deliver 9% plus or minus growth for the full year. We do believe that we're being impacted this quarter, obviously, from the Delta variant of COVID. And it's still really early in our fiscal year. We just finished one quarter. So it'd be unusual for us to raise our revenue guidance after one quarter. And you put the Delta variant on top of that. You know, that's why we didn't raise. But we also said that our guidance did assume that we don't necessarily make back all of the procedures that we might lose during Delta variant. We certainly hope that we do, and past experience would show that we do. But that just shows you that we're taking a really conservative stance with our revenue guidance of 9+%, 9+ or -% for the year.
Got it. Copy that. Well, let's hope that the recovery from that Delta variant will indeed be as compressed as you said, and we're all hoping for. Karen Parkhill, good to catch up with you again, Medtronic CFO, and our Anjali Kamlani. Thanks, Karen. Be well.
We'll be right back. On this Women's Equality Day, we thought we'd take a closer look at how the pandemic has disproportionately affected women economically. And depending on which study you look at, the pandemic either halted progress on closing the gender pay gap, or there was a slight bit of progress, but that progress is really the result of more women at the lowest end of the pay scale either losing their jobs or leaving them to care for their families, and so no longer showing up as part of the workforce. Tiffany Pham is founder and CEO of the HR tech company Mogul, which is working to close the equality pay gap, and she joins me now. Tiffany, it's good to see you here on the show. Maybe you could just fill us in on what has happened to women's earning power during the pandemic.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. And, you know, it's been really unfortunate throughout this time, throughout the pandemic. Women continue to earn, unfortunately, only 82 cents on the dollar compared to men. And throughout the pandemic, we've been set back. You know, throughout the pandemic, there's been a number of issues that have continued to set us back, whereby before the pandemic, we were already 65 years behind men with regards to reaching parity at top leadership levels, for example. And now another 35 years set back by this pandemic, such that it's going to be another 100 years before we ultimately reach parity at top leadership levels. So a number of issues that have ultimately, because of the pandemic, led us to a slowdown before we reach parity.
So we've got a graphic up right now showing the fight for equal pay for women of color. And talk to us a little bit about what things have been like for that segment of the population when it comes to pay equality.
So definitely every segment of the population throughout, you know, women, Asian women, Black women, Hispanic women, have faced even more overarching inequality overall compared to all women. As I said, women overall, 82 cents on the dollar compared to men. But when it comes to Black women, we're only making, I think, 63 cents on the dollar. Latinx women, 55 cents on the dollar. This is 37% less than white men. This is less 30% less than white men, respectively. So overall, we have to continue to raise our voices, advocating for equal pay for equal work. And there's a lot more to do. And Mogul, as a company, what we do is, as a leading diversity recruitment company for the world, we work to ultimately provide our clients with the ability to bring women, minorities, to ultimately incredible opportunities within the workplace, and ultimately ensure that these companies are then bringing them these amazing opportunities at equal pay, at fair pay, and ultimately ensuring that these companies are then bringing them into these amazing environments that are inclusive, where they can belong.
I know that you work with a lot of Fortune 500 companies there at Mogul, and we now know that a record number of females are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, a whopping 41 of them. So 8.1% of the overall companies in the Fortune 500 company are run by females. That is progress, and we don't want to not shine a light on that. But how is Mogul helping to hopefully increase that number over time?
That is definitely progress, but I look forward to the day where we can say at least 50% of companies at the Fortune 500 are being run by women, if not more. Mogul is definitely helping to progress this number. We are, again, a leading diversity recruitment company that is not only providing software services to enable our clients to source overall talent for overall roles, so as to ensure more diverse workforces overall, but we also provide executive search and board search services for our clients to be able to diversify their leadership at director, VP, C-suite, and board levels as well. So as a result, we're creating incredible opportunities for our women, minority, people of color, diverse candidates across our ecosystem to now have the opportunity to be placed at the C-suite at the board level of amazing Fortune 500 company clients like Chanel, UBS, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Intuit, MasterCard, eBay, and more, and have, again, opportunity to now lead these companies to incredible heights and themselves on a personal level reach their greatest heights. So it's an amazing opportunity to be creating amazing impact for now women as part of Women's Equality Day, to now have an amazing at the forefront of this movement, an opportunity to lead this movement, to now help women reach the very top.
What do you make, though, of places like the NASDAQ market site, for instance, mandating that companies that list there have at least two diverse people on their boards? It depends, you know, company by company, it could be a person of color or a woman on the board. But is it really the place of somebody like the NASDAQ to put these mandates on privately held publicly traded companies?
I personally am a friend of the NASDAQ team, actually helping to create these guidelines, and the organizations are collaborating as well. And so, of course, on a personal level, on an organization level, I greatly believe in what they're doing. I really commend them for their efforts because somebody has to do it. And so NASDAQ, whether it's Mogul, NASDAQ, somebody has to ultimately state what is right, state ultimately, especially in their position, what they believe in, and especially if they have the platform and the power and the influence and the impact to be able to create this opportunity, this guideline, then so be it, so that ultimately other companies can follow suit. So I greatly commend NASDAQ, their team, for what they're doing. And it's just the start. Hopefully the New York Stock Exchange can follow suit, others can follow suit, and it can create bigger impact in this way.
All right, Tiffany Pham, founder and CEO of Mogul. Good to see you today. Thanks so much.
James Smucker is out with his latest earnings report, highlighting strength in Meow Mix, cat food, Uncrustables snacks, and Cafe Bustelo coffee. But the company's outlook is garnering some attention this morning on Wall Street. Citing mostly supply chain inflation, James Smucker cut its full-year earnings and free cash flow guidance. Let's dive in here with James Smucker, President and CEO Mark Smucker. Mark, always good to see you here. So, look, the fundamentals in many parts of the business, they look pretty solid. Cat mix, Uncrustables, many parts of the coffee portfolio. But it looks like you did see a good bit of cost inflation in the quarter. What areas of the business surprised you on this front?
So, Brian, first of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. The fundamentals of our business are very strong, and we grew all of our U.S. retail businesses, even our away-from-home businesses, as folks begin to travel and schools are coming back in session. All of our business did grow top line, and so you would have seen about a 1% comparable growth year over year and 6% versus 2 years ago. So clearly the fundamentals, the brands are strong. We continue to invest in our business, and we actually have started to recover some of these cost increases through pricing actions as well as productivity. However, the inflation that we're seeing is beyond what we expected. And so we will continue to price to recover, working very closely with our retail customers to ensure that we can pass along those cost increases, which will lag somewhat the costs themselves.
Are you confident, just looking at the guidance, you did cut it versus prior expectations. Are you confident that you won't have to cut it again based on where you are in terms of inflation?
Yes, we are confident. You know, there's a lot of volatility. We have had some unique weather events as well in both Brazil and here in the U.S. and the Pacific Northwest, which have affected our business. But we do feel that our current revision to our profit guidance is appropriate. And again, continuing to invest in our business to support and continue to grow our top line.
Mark, it's Julie here. I wonder if you could give us a little bit more color around those costs, where you're seeing the biggest increases, both geographically and in what items, and then what kind of visibility you have as to which ones are going to be most enduring.
Sure. So first of all, it's across the board in our entire industry. So all of our peers and competitors are experiencing similar impacts to both ingredients, packaging, transportation. There are some labor challenges. And so all of that is factoring in here. And we are just, the most important thing for us is to remain focused on executing the business. Our people have done an unbelievable job managing the supply chain tightness, the tightness in transportation, all the way through to the retail shelves. And it's really because of the discipline that we have had to execute that we have had success through the pandemic and will continue to going forward.
And Mark, I'm curious if you could just maybe give us some color on what the business looks like on a two-year stack. We've seen that from a lot of different companies, you know, across industries, and just a sense of what trajectory you guys are on today versus where you were pre-pandemic. Obviously, a huge event for the packaged foods business that you guys are in, but you know, how do those kind of trends stack up?
Sure. So I mentioned earlier that on a two-year stack basis, our total sales are up 6%, and that is backing out some of the noise around our divestitures. Coffee up 8%, pet up 3%, and our consumer foods business, which is peanut butter and jelly and Uncrustables, up 4%, 4% being on a year-over-year basis, but all of those businesses being up on a two-year stack basis. So very, very strong growth.
Mark, since we last spoke, coffee bean prices have really accelerated and in many respects gone through the roof. How have you had to take price increases in a Folgers, Cafe Bustelo? And if you have, how much have you taken?
Yeah, so we have already taken some pricing on our entire line of coffee. I would tell you that the costs, although they are increasing, they are far from record highs. And so although we continue to see increases into the future, we do believe that we will be able to price for those. And again, if you look at our portfolio, Folgers as a mainstream iconic sort of anchor brand for the category, our brands of Bustelo as well as Dunkin' are really driving the growth across the portfolio as well as our K-Cup business on all brands.
You know, a fun last one for you. So I noted, so in the quarter for you, peanut butter was a strong area of business for you, but fruit spreads were down. Now, when I think of the two, I'm thinking peanut butter and jelly here. Are people just eating sandwiches with peanut butter and forgetting the fruit spread? Have you decoded this at all?
Well, thanks. You know, our total consumer business, as I said, did grow 4%, and we did continue to grow share in fruit spreads. So peanut butter and jelly obviously go hand in hand. And as consumers have shifted to convenience items, our Uncrustables business continues to be on fire. We've had 29 consecutive quarters of growth on Uncrustables. And we continue to invest in capacity because we see a lot more future growth in the next few years. We should exceed $500 million in sales on Uncrustables alone.
Wow, I remember when that first launched. That is a product that has definitely come a long way since I remember it. We'll leave it there. James Smucker, President and CEO, Mark Smucker, always good to see you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Brent.
Although Wall Street economists are out there slashing their GDP forecast because of the Delta variant, most macro folks still agree the U.S. labor market will continue its recovery well into 2022, and that could be a nice tailwind to payroll services company Paychex. Joining us now is Paychex President and CEO Marty Mucci. Marty, good to see you again this morning. Good to see you at the NASDAQ back out celebrating your 50th anniversary here. Like I mentioned, I can't think of a better company that has a better pulse on the health of the labor market. What are you seeing in the labor market right now? Are you seeing the recovery stall a bit because of concerns around Delta?
No, actually, right at this point, we're still seeing a pretty consistent improvement, particularly in the leisure and hospitality team. You know, we're employee set. We're seeing the growth pick back up. It's almost back up to our base levels of our small business index, which was set in 2004. So job growth getting back to kind of that level. So certainly some things like construction are slowing a bit. I think that's raw materials and supply. But leisure and hospitality, other services, certainly picking up still very strong.
Hi, Marty. It's Julie here. You know, as you kind of reflect on, obviously, you haven't been there all the 50 years, but as you reflect on this history of the company, you know, we've been talking a lot over the past year about how much the job market has changed, sort of the power dynamics and so many other aspects of it. From your perspective, what is the biggest change or the biggest changes that you have seen over the past 18 months?
Well, I think it's been mobility and the ability to get to clients our businesses and their employees wherever they want to be and serve them however they want to be served. You know, I think it has accelerated all of the thinking of I can be from anywhere and get work done, and the digitalization basically of the market, meaning that you have to be able to serve with your products and services anywhere. You know, our mobile app, the use of our five-star mobile app at Paychex has increased dramatically in the last 18 months, and it's giving you anything from your net pay to be able to move money, look at your retirement plan. Everyone is expecting that their mobile apps that are going to be the same as, you know, their peer-to-peer apps, their consumer type of apps. So we've seen a great increase in mobility and the ability of innovation and the technology we've introduced at Paychex, particularly in the last 8 to 10 years, really make a huge difference during this pandemic.
And Marty, just to follow up on that, if mobility is the biggest change, what's the biggest challenge associated with that? Is it that you're dealing with more, you know, employers are dealing with more different tax regimes that they then have to funnel through your software and technology, or are there other issues?
No, I think the biggest challenge right now for businesses, particularly small and mid-sized businesses, is just how to handle, you know, not being able to find enough employees. You know, this is the big challenge right now, in particular the last 3 months. How do I find enough employees and retain employees? There's a tremendous amount of turnover in all industries, really, of people just deciding to go to other jobs. Also, some staying at home still. Don't think it's just the unemployment, the higher unemployment benefit. I do think we don't see a big correlation there. I think it's more just still concerns about COVID, concerns about childcare, and deciding, you know, just what they want to do with their life because they've been home and created new habits. So it's really this enormous change in the workforce right now is, it's never really seen anything like it in certainly the last 10 or 20 years. So it's a big challenge for businesses. How do I hire, onboard, and retain and develop employees?
And Marty, the return to office dates for many very large companies, I'm sure a lot that you work with, those are being pushed back until later this year, in some cases into 2022. Have you seen a pickup in the HR part of your business?
Oh, definitely. The HR outsourcing, the support, you know, that is needed to be able to handle COVID policy, return to work policy. Now the big issue, right, with Delta coming out with its announcement is, do we change our healthcare premiums? What do I do with healthcare? Do I offer different healthcare premiums to my employees who are vaccinated or not vaccinated? All of these questions, it's never been so complex for businesses to handle HR. And it's that recruiting, hiring and retaining and developing, but it's also things like, how do I handle medical benefits? How am I going to charge my employees and that kind of thing? It's never been more need for HR support than right now.
Yeah, Delta, speaking of Delta, they really took a strong stand yesterday, Marty. Is that announcement from a Delta, is that now something you are looking to implement inside your own company?
We are. We're looking at it because the cost is very high. And, you know, you can talk about whether to mandate the vaccinations or not for your employees. But also, you need to be able to say, hey, there are consequences. There are costs that come with not being vaccinated. And I think Delta had made the comment that the average hospital stay for someone not vaccinated is like $50,000. You don't want to spread that to all of your employees. So you have to find ways, just like smoking and non-smoking, ways to try to get the cost to the possible cost causer and be as fair as you can to your employees to keep your rates down for health insurance.
So just following up on that. So at Paychex, your premiums might go up a couple hundred dollars if you work there?
For our employees, they may go up. We're looking at that now to see what's the fairest way to handle that. And our, you know, benefits will come up for renewal this fall and then go to our employees. And it's something that trying to keep the rates down for all of our employees may be something that we have to do as well.
Fair enough. We'll leave it there. Paychex President and CEO Marty Mucci. Always good to see you. Good to see you out there getting more mobile down at the NASDAQ. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.
Well, Salesforce shares are popping today after the software giant beat expectations on its top and bottom lines. There you can see handed beats revenue there coming in at $6.34 billion, adjusted earnings $1.48 a share. The company also raised its full-year earnings outlook, which included a big boost from the newly completed acquisition of messaging platform Slack. And for more on that, happy to welcome into the program here, Bret Taylor, Salesforce President and Chief Operating Officer, joins us alongside Yahoo Finance's Julia LaRoche as well. And Bret, I mean, I guess we'll just start on the big beat here, and particularly how large of a factor Slack's already playing. 30 million $1 more than you guys predicted just one quarter ago. So talk to me about how that's already setting this combination up to look rather strong.
Well, you know, look, we actually raised our full year guidance by $300 million. And it's not only the relevance of Slack, it's actually just growth across our core business. You know, we've talked a lot about digital transformation, particularly with this Delta variant and the digitization of the economy. Well, digital transformation starts and ends with your customer. Every board, every CEO, their main agenda is getting back to growth, and that starts with our customers and it starts with CRM. So we're really excited about Slack. It cannot be a more relevant product at a more relevant time. We're also just incredibly excited about the strength of our core CRM business, digital sales, digital customer service, digital marketing. That's the conversation on every CEO's mind right now.
You know, you're talking about a lot of companies getting back to growth. And I also heard you on the call, Brett, really talking about the momentum you're seeing at Salesforce is unlike any momentum you've seen at any company you've been at. This is the first quarter you all surpassed $6 billion, as we were just talking about, raising that guidance, this flywheel you have going on. I heard Mark Benioff say you all want to hit $50 billion in revenue by 2026. So I am curious, where are the areas of growth at Salesforce that you're most excited about?
You know, Julia, it's really across the whole portfolio, and that's what's amazing. Our Sales Cloud accelerated to 15% year-over-year growth because every selling team is saying, what is the future of digital sales? How can I get back to growth? Our Service Cloud business, this is a $6 billion business growing over 23% year-over-year. And it's because contact centers are moving from buildings to being in the cloud. Companies are investing in self-service and in chatbots. And you look at marketing and commerce, I mean, digital marketing and digital commerce are the lifeblood of every consumer goods and retail company right now. And it's just everything's growing incredibly well. And I think it's because our products are just more relevant than they've ever been. You know, I think every CEO is realizing that this pandemic's not going away. We're in a new pandemic world, an all digital work anywhere world. And companies are investing in their digital infrastructure so that they can set themselves up to grow in this new world.
Well, Brett, you, Mark Benioff, certainly Salesforce, were really far ahead on this trend of, as you just said, this kind of success from anywhere, work from anywhere, digital world. And we did kind of see this debate play out across corporate America of some folks said, you know, this thing will be over. We'll head back to the office. Maybe there's this hybrid, or you all kind of pointing to this remote work from anywhere world. I am curious from the perspective of these more traditional, let's call it Fortune 500 CEOs, maybe more legacy business, not necessarily the digital native ones. What are you hearing from those CEOs now about their thoughts on the future of work?
You're absolutely right. I mean, a handful of months ago, it was all over the board. You know, CEOs said, we're all going back to the office. Some younger companies saying we don't have offices anymore. I think the reality is now everyone's realizing that every company needs a digital HQ. I'm an entrepreneur. I've started two companies before, and I loved starting those companies. And the first thing I did was pick out my office space. Now, if I was starting another company, I'd start by picking out my digital HQ, because this is actually in this world where people are working flexibly, maybe only in the office a couple days a week. This is a starting point for building a company culture. And more importantly, as you look at what drives your growth right now across sales, customer service, and marketing, you start with your digital HQ first. And I think, especially with the Delta variant and the, you know, the realization that this isn't just going to snap back, I think every board, every CEO now is realizing that investing in your digital employee experience, your digital partner experience, and your digital customer experience is paramount if you want to grow in this new normal.
And of course, critical to that is the Slack acquisition that you all made. I know you did a presentation recently on what folks can expect from Slack, but you mentioned being a business person, two exits that you've had from building businesses and kind of thinking about this digital HQ, if you will. What are the gaps or the areas that you hope to fill? You mentioned culture. How do you kind of keep the culture quotient in the digital world and, you know, addressing things like so folks don't feel lonely at work? How are you thinking about those things?
It's such a great question. I don't know if we have all the answers. I think all of us have experienced, you know, video conferencing fatigue. And if there's anything that I've learned, it's that digital transformation is not digital translation. And, you know, for all the companies that took all the meetings they had in conference rooms and moved them to video conference rooms, that's not really a digital version of your company. That's just translating the analog to the digital. And I think what I'm really excited about with tools like Slack is they really represent a vision for a new way to work, more asynchronous, that provides more flexibility to your employees, that enables you, if you're a selling team, to close the quarter better and faster because you're doing it using new tools and new workflows that are fundamentally reimagining the way that we work. So I can't tell you I have all the answers about the future of work. I think we're all going to build that together as the pandemic subsides and we learn to learn and live in this new pandemic world. What's exciting for me with Slack as a part of the Salesforce portfolio is we can be trusted digital advisors to our customers and help them on that journey.
And already, it's good to see that already in this quarter here as, you know, the battle, as we've documented, is intense, Microsoft Teams and those other options out there, but clearly showing the right step forward there. Brett Taylor, appreciate you coming on here. Salesforce President, Chief Operating Officer there alongside Yahoo Finance's Julie Roche as well. Thanks again.